Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and November is National Diabetes Month, and my guest today is a very important guest because we're talking about diabetes, we're talking about cancer, we're talking about how to lose weight and enjoy food. And listen, we're in the middle, end of a pandemic. All of us are putting on weight. It's almost a joke. Oh, I ate all my pandemic food. Now what do I do? We just came out of Thanksgiving and now we're looking at Christmas. And honestly, I was telling Dr. John in my virtual green room that I'm uncomfortable from yesterday. I ate way too much. So we're going to talk about how you can, you know, pay attention to what you're doing, how you're living, how you're conducting business, how you're treating yourself, how you're treating other people. So let me tell you a bit about him because I'm really excited that he's here. So Dr. John Batuli joins me to share four revolutionary ideas to prevent diabetes, lose weight, and enjoy food. I've got three of his books on my desk today, and we're going to be picking a little bit out of two of them in particular to talk about things that are very important to us right now. The first one is Eat, Chew, Live, and how, and that is capitalized, H-O-W, capitalized, how you eat matters more than what you eat. Now, he has written, Dr. John has written articles on hunger and satiation, weight loss, diabetes, and the senses of taste and smell. His articles have been published in medical journals such as Physiology and Behavior, Neuroscience and Biobehavioral Reviews, Journal of Women's Health, Journal of Applied Research, Nutrition and Nutritional Neuroscience. His work has also been quoted in Woman's Day, I've never read that, Fitness, Red Book, and Woman's World. And he became interested in understanding the causes of and the interconnections between hunger, satiation, and weight gain. And I think we're all really wanting to know about that. His interest turned into a passion and a multi-decade personal study and research project that led him to read many journal articles, medical journal articles, medical textbooks, and other scholarly works in biology, biochemistry, physiology, endocrinology. I'm sorry.
Endocrinology, yes.
Okay, I knew I was butchering that. And cellular metabolic functions. And he continued researching the linkage between obesity, diabetes, and cancer, and developed additional insights into the causes of childhood and adult cancer. That's another book I have here, and possible treatments. And if you're asking why we're having this discussion on a business podcast, I'm going to tell you right now, if you don't feel good, it's hard to do business. It's hard to be an entrepreneur. If you're dragging yourself from bed back to bed and you're just exhausted all the time, you're not at your best, and that's why he's here. Good morning, Dr. John, and thank you for being here with me today, the day after Thanksgiving. I really appreciate it.
Denise, I thank you, and I thank our listeners.
Well, listen, I've got these books, and I mentioned that I have two of them in particular. Well, there's three of them here that I want to mention because they're important. One is Surviving Cancer, A New Perspective on Why Cancer Happens and Your Key Strategies for a Healthy Life. And the other one is Insights and Information to Empower Parents When Your Child Has Cancer. Listen, you can't hardly go on Facebook or Twitter or any place else and people are asking for prayers for their family, for their children. People are getting sicker and sicker and sicker and bigger. So I am delighted that you're here and I can't wait to hear what you have to share with us.
Well, the first thing is, as a nation, we are becoming more and more obese. 75 to 80% of the people in this country overweight, and more than 30% are clinically obese. Now, what is obesity? Let's start with that. Most people visually look at a person and say, oh, he is obese. To me, that is a cosmetic obesity. I differentiate that from medical obesity. Let me give you an example. When I was in practice, I was practicing mostly allergy and immunology, but two people with allergies came to me, both white American males, both weighed 300 pounds each. Both were told their family doctors they should lose weight because based on the weight table, they both were obese. So I asked the first person, what is your blood pressure? Normal. What is your fasting blood sugar? Normal. What is your fasting triglyceride? Triglyceride is a term you may not pay attention to. I hope you do from now on, because that's the name of fat that is circulating in the blood. That fat is the ritual that is stored, and that makes you look obese because you're storing fat. It is called triglyceride. When you have an annual blood test, that number is there, but most doctors don't pay attention to it, but you should. Anyway, in this person, he, medically speaking, everything was normal. So I told him, you may have more muscles, you may have thick bone, you inherited a tendency to have strong bones, you are not medically obese as far as I'm concerned. If you want to lose weight, that's fine. If you have any joint issues, that's a reason, but he did not have any. The second person was already on two anti-diabetic medications, and his doctor was asking him to start insulin for control of his blood sugar. I told him, yes, he is medically overweight because his fasting blood sugar is high, his fasting triglyceride was high, and hemoglobin A1C was high. He was already on. He, to me, was medically obese. So it is differentiated between the cosmetic obesity and medical obesity. Let me give you another example. Let's have a young lady with no family history of diabetes. She's pregnant. At the end of second trimester of pregnancy, 8 to 9 weeks into pregnancy, she's diagnosed as gestational diabetes. No previous history of diabetes, no family history. Why did she become diabetic?
I don't know.
People who are in the United States, 80% of type 2 diabetic people. By the way, we are talking about type 2 diabetes, not type 1. I will say the difference in just a minute. 80% of people, adults who are type 2 diabetics in this country are obese, whereas in India, 60% of type 2 diabetics are not obese. So how can they become diabetics if obesity is the reason for type 2 diabetes? Now, Dennis, please interrupt me anytime you want to, but I'm going to continue.
Oh, no. Keep going. Yeah. I'm actually taking notes.
The diabetes is diagnosed when your blood glucose level is found higher than normal, and it will keep going up. It is classified into two groups, type 1 and type 2. The difference is, in type 1, insulin is absent. In type 2, insulin is present. Now, to understand the significance of that, you need to know what role insulin plays in the body. Suppose you live in an apartment or a house. When the doorbell rings, you know there is somebody outside. That you have to go and open the door to let that person in. Every cell in the body can use glucose to extract energy. However, there is no doorbell for glucose to ring to let the cell know glucose is outside. That is the role of insulin. Insulin does not get into the cell. All it does is go with glucose molecule and ring the doorbell. Even then, the glucose cannot get in automatically. The cell has to send in a wagon. a glucose transport wagon to the door, open the door, load up the wagon with glucose, whatever it needs, and bring it in. Now we can see in type 1 diabetic, mostly happens in childhood, if insulin is not there, their pancreas got damaged, maybe it autoimmune disease, and no insulin. That means the blood sugar builds up in the blood, yet the cells are starving. These children used to die before age 10 until insulin was discovered almost 100 years ago. When insulin was given to them, their lifespan became normal. In type 2 diabetics, insulin is already present, yet the blood sugar goes up. How can this happen? According to diabetology experts, if you go to the website of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, you will see that type 2 diabetes usually starts when muscle, liver, and fat cells do not use insulin well. This is known as the insulin resistance theory. The problem is this theory has never been validated. In any branch of science, if you have a hypothesis, before it is accepted as fact, you have to validate it through three steps. First is called logic. It should make sense. For example, human body has 200. Why only three become resistant? What about the others? Nobody has an explanation. Second validation point is mechanism. What is the reason the cell is not responding? Is it because the doorbell is not ringing? Or is the signal not going to the gene in charge? Or is the gene incapacitated? Or the wagon is not working? There is no mechanism. And it's a defective mechanism, same in all three sites. We don't know. Nobody knows. The third validation point is measurement. You should be able to measure the degree of insulin resistance. Have you ever heard of a test to measure the degree of insulin resistance in a diabetic?
No, but I don't know much. No, but honestly, I don't know much about diabetes. The only reason I've become recently interested in it is because my brother, who is a double lung transplant patient, now has type 2 diabetes. So now, of course, I need to know more.
Yes. So there is no measurement whether you are newly diagnosed, whether you have had it for 20 years, whether you are developing complications. Is it because your insulin resistance is getting worse? Nobody knows. Even more important, suppose you give somebody an injection of insulin. The blood glucose level goes down. Does that mean now the insulin resistance is lower? Without a measurement, how do you know? By the way, if you are resistant to an antibiotic, the doctor will not give you that antibiotic, right?
Right.
Right?
He shouldn't.
Yeah.
Not,
but here
you
are told
you
are type 2 diabetic because you are resistant to insulin. And what does the doctor give you?
Insulin.
Right. That is the type of things that I could not understand. That is why I started looking into that. There is something that does not make sense. So now let's go back to the young lady who is diagnosed gestational diabetes. Why? What I am suggesting is the number one problem for obesity as well as type 2 diabetes is our increased intake of grain-based foods, wheat, rice, and corn. And how is that possible? Let's look at grains. First of all, if nature intended grains for humans, in my opinion, we would have had beaks to pick them up and the ability to digest the chaff.
I've heard this before, and I tend to agree with you. And honestly, as I get a little bit older, I find that I'm allergic, not terribly so, but if I eat white bread or white rice or white anything, after a while, I'm, you know, I just kind of get very choked up. I just kind of feel sick for a little bit, and then it passes 15 or 20 minutes, but I don't feel good. So I tend to avoid it unless it's Thanksgiving. And I'll tell you, I'm paying the price right now. I'm really kind of miserable. I hate to say it, but I'm not happy in my body right now. I ate too many grains and white biscuits and if it was there, I ate it. We all do. And boy, I'm paying the price today.
Let me look at two pieces of evidence I suggest normally. The Native Americans, when they were brought to reservations, they had complete physical examination, blood test, and somebody did an extended review of the medical literature from 1832 to 1939 for 100 years, and the incidence of type 2 diabetes was extremely rare. They had 10 times more adults per 100,000 population above age 90 compared to white Americans, yet their diabetes rate was rare. In 2012, according to the Centers for Disease Control, the incidence of type 2 diabetes among Native Americans is 16%, that is double that of white Americans. Now, let me say a second piece of evidence, then I'll tell you why I think this happened. In 1974, or mid-1970s, an Australian researcher asked 10 Australian aborigines with type 2 diabetes whether they can go back to the bushes and live like their ancestors, the ancestral way of life. And these 10 said yes. They went back. They moved from one food source to another. They did not stay in one place. Wherever there was food, they moved. At the end of 8 weeks, by the way, that is why the title of my diabetes book is How to Reverse Type 2 Diabetes in 8 Weeks. By the end of 8 weeks, all of them lost weight. They were all able to stop their anti-diabetic medications. So what is the connection? What's the difference, or what's the similarity between the ancient or our Native Americans and the Australian aborigines? If you think about it, they did not stay in one place to cultivate grains. They moved from food source to food source. They ate everything else, fruits, nuts, animals, vegetables, fish, eggs, everything except grains. So what is wrong with grains? Each kernel of grain, by the way, it doesn't matter whether it's refined grain or whole grain, each kernel of grain has thousands of molecules of complex carbohydrate. Each molecule of complex carbohydrate can have up to 200,000 molecules of glucose. Let me repeat. Each molecule of complex carbohydrate, whether it is coming from wheat or rice or corn or even potato, it doesn't matter, has up to 200,000 molecules of glucose. So soon after a meal, the blood glucose level goes way high soon after a meal with grain flour-based foods. That really causes release of insulin. And as we discussed earlier, insulin instructs or informs every cell there is glucose outside. Each cell picks up what it needs. The leftover glucose will come to the liver. The liver can store only 120 milligrams of glucose, or 120 grams of glucose for backup as glycogen to be released back into the blood when the blood glucose level goes down. The rest of the glucose will be converted into fatty acid and to fat called triglyceride, as I mentioned earlier, to be stored in fat cells. Now, I want you to think about this. You inherit a certain amount of fat storage capacity from your ancestors, from your parents. So in India, people have been traditionally lean for thousands of years. In the Western countries, because of the weather pattern and availability of food, people have been more heavy, obese, let us say, or more fat in their body compared to Indians. So each one inherits a certain amount of fat storage capacity. When that storage capacity is full, the fatty acids stay in the blood. Now, even if you have not eaten all day, you can still function. Your muscles still produce energy. Why? Because our muscles are like a hybrid car. It can use either glucose or fatty acid to produce energy. So if you're running a marathon, you don't need to be taking glucose or food. You can keep running for hours. Why? Because the muscles will get produce energy from fatty acid. If the fatty acid level goes up in the blood because they cannot be stored in the fat cell, the muscles will automatically switch to fatty acid burning. And then, do the muscles need glucose? No. This is why even in the presence of insulin, muscles don't accept glucose because they just simply don't need it. And the blood glucose stays in the blood. The glucose stays in the blood. Blood level goes up and you are a diabetic. So it is primarily a lifestyle condition caused by excess intake of grain-based foods that provide an enormous amount of glucose inside. Now let's go back to that young lady who was pregnant. As soon as she is pregnant, everybody is going to tell her, okay, eat this food. This is good for the baby's brain. This is good for the baby's complexion. This is good for the baby's bone. And she eats and eats and eats, and she fills up her fat storage capacity. The glucose stays in the blood, and she's a diabetic. What happens after she delivers the baby? When she loses weight, she opens up, she empties out some fat cells, the glucose is now stored, her diabetes disappears. Does that make sense?
It does, and I did know that because I've known girls that, you know, that happened to them, and after they had the baby and got back to normal, or however normal you can get after having a baby, I don't know, but they were fine. Now, I have, while you're talking about the grain, I think I knew that. I think I had read some articles about grain being probably not the best thing to ingest, and I know that I shouldn't because it makes me sneeze. It, you know, I thicken up, my throat thickens, I get, you know, a little bit of bloated, and I start when I start sneezing, I know I ate something I shouldn't have been eating. But, and here's, you know, you're talking about grain as being the number one problem. I have often thought, and maybe this is where I'm dead wrong, that we eat a lot of garbage. Like, I have a favorite grocery store in here in Southwest Louisiana, and when you go into the right side of the store, it's beautiful. Everything is freshly sourced from the Gulf of Mexico. I go buy my shrimp, my crabs, you know, anything fresh. It came straight out of the boat. You know, they have organic foods in there. It's beautiful. The lighting is light. It's beautiful. Then you make a left in that store and you wander over to where, you know, it's brightly lit. It's linoleum floors. Everything is in a box or a can. And I call that side of the store the side of the store you should never go into, because the only nutrition in my mind that you're going to get is licking the box, because what's in it is garbage. So how far wrong am I?
No, you are absolutely correct in the sense, if you look at the cheapest food available, by the way, the people in the lower socioeconomic status with low income are suffering the most with obesity and type 2 diabetes. Why?
I've noticed that. They eat junk.
They are eating what's called convenient food, easily transportable food, prepackaged foods, and almost all of them are made with grains and grain flour products. That's the cheapest food available.
But I was going
Why?
To ask you about
because
sugar as well.
The federal government is subsidizing to the tune of $25 billion a year. And then that leads to obesity, type 2 diabetes. We are spending as a nation, our cost of medical care related to, directly and indirectly related to diabetes and obesity, is $1 billion a day right now. Billion, that's 90. If you want to save Medicare for our kids and grandkids, The easiest way to do that will be to control type 2 diabetes. That's all we need to do.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. So that is the food coming from the cheapest food available. And what happens is, now let's go back to the mindful eating or the eat you live. Is there, this is the solution that I'm proposing. Is there any food in nature that adult humans can get nutrients from? By the way, human body needs over 100 different nutrients, and you cannot get it from one food group or one meal. Is there any food in nature that human adults can get nutrients from without chewing?
Honey, but I don't know how many nutrients are in it.
Right. And that is not meant for humans, and everybody cannot get honey either. Yes, that is the only thing. So everything else requires chewing. Why?
Oh.
Now, let me give you an example of why. If you are thirsty right now, can you predetermine how much water will it take to quench your thirst? Can you?
No. No, not a bit.
How long will it take to drink the water, enough water to quench your thirst?
You know, I don't know, but I drink a lot of water. And right now I'm looking at 4 different bottles of water on my desk. If I'm starting to get a headache, it's because I forgot to drink water. And I grab a bottle and I immediately take care of that headache because I know I'm thirsty.
How long will it take for you to drink it?
To drink it? If I drink the entire bottle, a minute?
No, just to quench your thirst right now. How much food?
Well, I just did. While you were talking, I muted and I drank about half a bottle of water. So 30 seconds.
30 seconds. By the time you finish drinking, your thirst is quenched. Where is that water? That water is still in your stomach. It has not been absorbed into the body yet. How does the brain know you had enough water? If you have been exercising or running and sweating, you'd have had more. So you adjust the quantity of intake based on the need in the body. That's the point I'm making. So how did the brain know? What I'm suggesting is, as you are drinking, there are receptors in the mouth, taste buds and smell receptors. They latch on to the molecules to identify what is coming into the body and report to the brain not only the nature of the nutrient coming in, but also the quantity. That is why you don't drink to fill up your stomach. You drink enough to quench your thirst. Similarly, there is a mechanism for eating also. In order for that to function properly, you need to chew your food, because that releases the nutrients at a rate where the taste buds and the smell receptors can detect and report to the brain. If you eat too fast, then the quantity control is lost because there's nobody metering it. If you chew it, then the brain will know. And the first bite, if you are hungry, first of all, you should eat only when you are hungry. Then the brain is prepared. The first bite is so enjoyable, but after a few minutes, the intensity of enjoyment goes down. That is the time to stop eating, regardless of what is left in your plate. All you have to do is to identify or appreciate what I'm trying to say. Look at toddlers, about 2 to 6 years of age. You will observe 3 things. One, they eat only when they are hungry. Second, they eat what they enjoy. Third, when the degree of enjoyment drops down, they stop regardless of what is left on the plate or in the plate. Why? Because their taste buds, they are listening to their brain. They are eating for satisfaction, not for fullness of the stomach. The grain-based foods, when you eat them, it absorbs water, just like grains absorb water, and you get the feeling of fullness of the stomach. So each time you eat, you're waiting for the fullness of the stomach to stop eating. You are eating too much. You should be looking for the taste. You should be looking for the enjoyment of eating. And when the intensity of enjoyment goes down, you stop eating. most of the grain-based foods. How much can you chew rice? How much can you chew pasta? How much can you chew noodles? How much can you chew bread? They don't allow you to chew, so that you eat fast, then you look for the fullness of the stomach. That is where the problem starts.
You know, that might explain why I don't really care for white bread. It's, to me, it's like eating a pillow. There's just nothing there. Unless I find a really good, hard, dense sourdough, because you have to chew that. I mean, that's work to eat that bread. But other than that, I tend to avoid white bread mostly because it just doesn't have any taste. I mean, there's just nothing to it. I don't like it. Never did like it.
Most of the grain flour-based foods, the taste comes from what is added to it. So if you have pasta, it is the pasta sauce that you are really enjoying.
Right.
So what I tell people is, if you are you not diluting the enjoyment of the pasta sauce by adding pastas to it? The same way with gravy and biscuits. The gravy is the enjoyable part, but if you add biscuit to it, you are diluting the enjoyment of the gravy just for the fact for taking the biscuit. But it is the biscuit that gives you the trouble, not the gravy. So put the gravy on steamed vegetables, and you can enjoy it as much and get more nutrients rather than putting more glucose molecules into your system. So this is what is going on for the last 50 years. People are eating more and more grain-based foods. They are getting obese. They are developing type 2 diabetes and also cancer. It is the same. Now, we are in the middle of a pandemic. People with type 2 diabetes have a higher incidence of severe complications from coronavirus pandemic. Do you know why? Have you thought about it? Hello? Hello?
I'm sorry, I lost you there for a moment. I was saying hello, hello, and I couldn't hear you.
Oh, I was saying hello, hello, and I couldn't hear you either. Anyway, during the coronavirus epidemic, the people with type 2 diabetes have a higher degree of severe complications, including ending up in the ICU and ventilator. Do you know why?
No, I don't.
First of all, how does the virus infect a person? It is in the air, you breathe it in. The virus has got two spikes. You have seen the diagram of the virus with the corona or spikes all around it. One spike latches on to your cell, and the other spikes makes a hole in the cell wall so that this virus can now get into the cell. Then the virus goes straight into the gene and into the nucleus and takes over the gene in charge of cell function and forces the gene to make a copy, an RNA messenger with the copy of the virus. And this is called the messenger RNA. And that is sent to the manufacturing facility in the cell, outside the nucleus, but in the cytoplasm. There, copies of the virus are made. And when the cell is full of those viruses come out of the cell and then infect other cells. So you breathe in the virus, it goes straight into your sinus, it multiplies there, then it drops down into the lungs and creates the same problem in the lungs. And what happens is, in order for the cell to produce new copies, it needs a source for energy and a source for materials and construction workers called enzymes. Glucose provides the energy, the fuel. So the higher your glucose level, the faster the manufacturing. And insulin promotes all cellular activities. Insulin doesn't know what you are doing is good or bad. It cannot make a value judgment, but it will promote, if you are producing more viruses, insulin will promote even more. It will push the workers, the enzymes, produce more and more. So you have a double whammy. You are providing glucose, you are providing an inspiration for the workers to work harder, and you have a higher load of viral production. And this is why you get sicker if you are a diabetic and if you are on insulin. So the solution is still the same. If you are a diabetic, especially if you are on insulin, cut down on your intake of grain-based foods to one half of what you are doing right now. You don't have to measure it. You don't have to calculate the energy content. The reason I'm saying one half is because the average American diet now provides 50 to 70% of energy from grains compared to what it was 100 years ago. At that time, it was 30 to 35%. So if we can cut down the intake of grain-based foods during each meal, breakfast, lunch, dinner. By the way, when is the last time you had a meal or a snack without a grain flour product?
Wasn't yesterday, I promise you that. That's a good question, and I don't normally think about that because I'm not big on grains anyway, but I do eat a lot of rice. I live in southwest Louisiana. We're probably going to give a pass on, you know, pasta, but we eat rice. I mean, that's a staple here.
Let me ask you this then. If you boil rice, can you enjoy it by itself?
I actually like it by itself, yes, but most people don't. They put crawfish on it.
There are very few, and you are lucky if you can enjoy it because then you can concentrate on stopping when the degree of enjoyment goes down. But for most people, the enjoyment comes from what is added to it rather than the rice by itself. So that is what I'm talking about. I'm not trying to reduce your enjoyment of eating. You should eat what you enjoy, but more importantly, enjoy what you eat. This is why the title says, how you eat matters more than what you eat. If you cannot enjoy it, what's the point in eating?
Yeah, and you don't want to eat until you're ready to throw up, and I've seen people do that. You know, you'll be with people, and all of a sudden they're grabbing their stomachs, oh, I ate too much. Again, we all did it yesterday. But watching the shoveling of food going in, I'm thinking, you're not enjoying it. You're not even tasting that anymore. And I've been guilty of it myself. We've all done it. You and I talked about this a month or two ago when we had our pre-interview. One of the things that I noticed probably when I was pretty young was that after about bite six, I didn't taste much anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you just don't.
Most of the people start having problems by age six. Again, as I asked earlier to observe toddlers. Why do they start having problems? Because they begin to listen to their parents.
Mm-hmm.
The parents will say, okay, we are not going to be stopping along the way. You better eat it. If you eat this, you can get the dessert. If you eat that, you will have this. So they gradually change the person's perception or the control mechanisms, and then we fall back on the fullness of the stomach. Then, of course, the school, the athletic activities, the work, each interferes with the time because you have no access to food when you are hungry. So that is a societal issue. That is where you have to get around that. If you can do that, you can be successful. What you need is each person needs to be in charge of what he or she puts into the mouth. When you sit down to eat, you have no clue what the body is looking for, how much carbohydrate, how much protein, how much amino acid, how many vitamins, minerals. Who knows? Only your subconscious mind. Let me give you this example. Suppose you and I go for a lunch, a Chinese buffet, 100 items for lunch. How many items will you choose?
Four.
Four, based on what?
I've had them before and I know that I like them. I'm kind of boring when it comes to food. I don't really want to play around.
That is a normal thing. You pick up what you have enjoyed in the past. You sit down. So we sit down. We sat down. We enjoyed it. Suppose we go back to the same buffet for evening, for supper. Will you take exactly the same four?
Probably.
Will you?
I've never done it, so that's a good question. I don't know.
Most people will take something else.
If it has broccoli in it, I'll take anything with broccoli. I'll take.
Okay, you know, certain foods that you may like, but exactly the same preparation. Suppose broccoli is a different preparation.
Oh.
Would you take that?
I'm going to have to think about that. I can't say yes or no.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, I don't.
Most people do something else. If you ask them why, it's a variety. They enjoy it because they had this earlier already. They won't enjoy it. Why? Because the nutrients that you got, your body got from lunch, they have not been used up. But the body has used up other nutrients, and your subconscious mind knows from previous experience which other food contain the nutrients the body needs right now. And it will suggest to the conscious part of the brain, oh, that one looks more appealing for supper. This one looks appealing. This one, no. So you select different ones, and you think you are in control. Yes, you are the final selection, but the information, the suggestion came from your subconscious mind. So when you go there, you don't even know, your conscious mind does not know what nutrients your body is looking for. How can anybody else give you a diet?
That's a good point. And I can tell you, while you were talking, I realized why I couldn't answer that, because I really almost never eat more than one meal a day. I don't eat breakfast.
Okay.
I only eat typically around, 1 or 2 o'clock when I am hungry. I don't like to eat dinner because I'm still, I know that I've still got food that has to be digested. I typically eat one good meal a day, and that's it.
Right. Yeah. So you cannot relate to what I have been
telling
you.
I know. And I couldn't figure out why I couldn't. It's like, wait a second, you don't eat dinner. Of course there's the answer.
So that is why we have to have a variety of types of food to get all the nutrients you need. And vegetables can provide most of the nutrients your body needs. If you have cancer, for example, you need to have a strong immune system. Because in my opinion, as I suggest in the Surviving Cancer book or in the Childhood Cancer, see, by the way, the average age of an adult with cancer is 60 plus. This is because experts say it takes accumulation of mutations for over 6 decades before a cancer cell to appear. The average age of a child with cancer is 6. So the child has not lived long enough to develop mutations. So why should a child even have cancer? So that is...
I have often wondered.
Yeah, that is the answer in my last book, When Your Child Has Cancer, published 2 months ago, available on Amazon, and also you can go to my website, drjohnonhealth.com, to get information about any of these books. So in this book, what I'm suggesting is every human body has precancerous cells, what I call cancer stem cell. Let me make a note about stem cell. Stem cell is the mother cell that produces baby cells. If you get a cut on your skin, that wound heals because there are skin stem cells at the bottom of your skin that produces new cells until the wound is healed. So a stem cell is the mother cell. And there are stem cells with a defect. The maximum number of precancerous stem cells is present in the fetus when you are in the mother's womb. That is the maximum number. The nature knows this can happen because you are producing cells by the millions in a matter of 9 months. One single stem cell that was produced when the sperm fertilized the egg, that one single stem cell called the zygote has to produce a baby containing 30 to 32 trillion cells in a matter of 9 months. You can imagine how fast they are multiplying. So they make mistakes, and each mistake is called a mutation. So you can have a cancer stem cell with the potential for uncontrolled multiplication in the body of the child, or all of us, very likely it is there. If it gets the right start multiplying, then it is a fight between the immune system on the one side. By the way, almost all the 99% of the precancerous cells in the human fetus are destroyed by the immune system. Only very few escape the immune surveillance program. So we have a very nice immune system to take care of the abnormal growth of cancer. So why do we have cancer? Because if the cancer cells multiply, if the cancer stem cell produces baby cells at a rate faster than the immune system can kill them, that is when cancer establishes. And what promotes this multiplication? Glucose. Why glucose? Because unlike muscle cells, which can extract energy from fatty acids, cancer cells almost exclusively use glucose. And where does the glucose come from? You know the answer.
The glucose, I think I do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Each time you eat a grain, flour-based food,
right,
you are providing
right
glucose.
I was thinking white bread.
Cell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to ask you, Dr. John, too, because this is kind of a two-part question here. We're talking about grains, but we're also, you know, the holidays are approaching, and I wanted to talk with you about how we can really go back to eat, chew, live, and how we can avoid more holiday weight gain. But I wanted to ask you about sugar, because sugar, I'll be honest with you, I don't like sugar. I never liked it. We didn't have it as children. We weren't, you know, taught that it was a good thing to have in our diets. And frankly, it hurts me. If I get too much sugar by accident, I gag and I spit it back out, or it hurts my ear. I don't know why. It just hurts my ear. I don't like it. I don't like the taste of it. I don't like sweet foods. But I watch people and, you know, I read about the, and sugar seems to be getting a really bad rap. Is that legitimate or no? I mean, I just don't like it. So, you know, there's that. But a lot of people in the holiday, Christmas is coming. Holy geez, the sugar sales, I think, are going to go through the roof as people make fudge and cookies and, you know, they're gifting baked goods. I mean, what do we think about sugar?
First of all, let us clarify the word sugar. Blood sugar is glucose. Table sugar is sucrose. These are two entirely different molecules. Yes.
And
sucrose.
See, that's what I'm asking, is table sugar, the white sugar. That stuff is just nasty.
And, you know, people get confused because of the word sugar. And you can see almost every person diagnosed with diabetes, the first thing they do is they stop eating table sugar. But that does not make any difference to their blood sugar level. You can ask them. If it was that simple, all you have to do is stop table sugar and your diabetes should get better. That doesn't happen. Why? Because the blood sugar, which is glucose, that comes straight from grains in our modern day diet. So what I'm suggesting is, if you enjoy natural sugar, that is fine. There is nothing wrong with that. There are no studies to show natural sugar contributes to type 2 diabetes. The only way it contributes is if the concentration of sugar in your food is higher than what is normally available in nature. So if you take the sweetness of a fruit, if your preparation, whatever dessert or whatever you are making, if the intensity of sweetness is similar to that in a fruit, you are fine as long as you can chew the food and control the quantity. If you add more sugar than what is available in nature, whether it is in a drink or a dessert, then your brain cannot adjust or tell you how the quantity. That is the problem. So it is not the sugar per se that is a problem. It is how you eat it.
Oh,
does that make
okay.
sense?
It does. It really does. But sugar is, from what I can tell, there's a big push now to blame weight gain on sugar, which seems a little unfair. I mean, we're eating a lot of other junk.
The problem with that is, who benefits from that push? The people who are making money out of artificial or non-energy containing sweeteners. And
like
the problem with
think.
That is, now you are telling the person, oh, this doesn't taste sweet, this is not sweet, so you can eat more. So they feel comfortable, they end up gaining more weight in the long term. This has been shown both in animal studies and human studies, that people who don't eat regular sugar but go for artificial or non-nutritive sweeteners, they end up gaining more weight because they feel comfortable and that they are reassured that they can eat more because there is no sweetness. That is the problem. So that
gotcha.
Has been, yeah. So you feel complacent. You will, oh, okay, I can eat this, I can eat more of it because it is not as sweet, and that is a problem. Secondly, people who are used to the artificial or non-energy sweeteners, if you ask them to enjoy a fruit, some of them, they have to add the artificial sweetener to the fruit before they can enjoy even the normal taste of a fruit. Why?
Oh.
Because the sweetness is not intense enough for them to enjoy.
Well, isn't it the same with table salt? I've seen people in restaurants, and I just assume, maybe this is an erroneous assumption, but I just assume that they're smokers because they will pick up the salt shaker and just turn their plate white without taking the first fork.
I'm sorry, we are talking about salt or?
Table salt. You
salt,
know, I've seen people
right?
just salt the heck out of a meal and they didn't even taste it first.
Yeah. What happens with salt is, that's a very interesting question. First of all, if you look at the label for the daily average, what you need is what minimum daily requirement. When it comes to salt, what they put on the label is the percentage in relation to the maximum tolerable amount, not what you need physiologically in
mm-hmm.
a day, but what you can tolerate. So what happens is, from childhood onwards, every processed food, whether it is a potato chips or any snack, they are all loaded with salt because it is a preservative. It stays, the shelf life is longer. As children, you get used to increased salt intake. And then you cannot enjoy the food unless you have a certain degree of salt and you add more and more salt. The average American intake of salt is 7 times that what is necessary for optimum health. 7 times. If you look
oh
at
my.
People who live in the jungles, a natural way of living, how much salt do they take? They practically
I would think none.
No, exactly. Whatever the nature provides, the sodium is there. So you can survive with very minimum salt. But you get used to the salt taste or salty taste, and then you have no escape. But
right.
you can change that pattern by gradually reducing the amount of salt in your diet. We have to do that. Otherwise, we are setting up our children for major problems as they grow up.
Oh, I don't doubt that. I have a super palate. I taste things that many people don't, and that's probably why I detest sugar so profoundly. But I don't want a lot of salt. Now, cayenne pepper? You can put that in my lemonade. I'll be fine with that. As long as there's no sugar, I'll put cayenne pepper in it. But I've noticed that the more junk we eat, and you're calling it processed foods, I'm calling it junk, And the more that we move away from fresher foods, and people say, oh, it's just so expensive to buy fresh foods. It's more expensive to die from cancer or diabetes.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not a valid argument for me.
Well,
but
in a way it is. When you have to put food on the table for everybody to eat enough, you go for the cheapest food available, especially if your income is less. So the question is,
how do you find a way to change that?
We have to start with the politicians. Why are we subsidizing grains? Why don't we have to start forcing them to change the subsidy to vegetable and fruit and nuts and spices? By the way, you mentioned cayenne pepper. Why do we enjoy that, the spices? Because if the spice does not provide a usable nutrient to the body won't enjoy it. You cannot eat sawdust, for example, because there are no nutrients there that the body can, human body can use. But in the spice, each spice has something that the body can use of 100 different nutrients. So yes, eat spices, eat herbs, eat mushrooms, eat nuts, eat fruits, eat vegetables. You can get all the nutrients you need, and you need a variety. So we need to start with the politicians to reduce the subsidy or redirect the subsidy from grains to vegetables and fruits. Then they will become cheaper.
Understood. Well, listen, we've got just a few more minutes, and I wanted to ask you, because one of the titles of your book is, well, it's part of the book title, Four Revolutionary Ideas to Prevent Diabetes. So can you give us the four ideas very quickly?
Yes. The first one is about diabetes, the first chapter. As I mentioned, my theory, it is not insulin resistance based. The second is, you have to be in charge of your own eating habits. Then the third thing is what I call the authentic weight. Don't go by your weight that you see on a scale or a BMI index, because each person is different, as you can understand from the example of the pregnant woman. Each person is different. The fourth one is eat what you enjoy, but more importantly, enjoy what you eat. We have the faculty, just like you exhibit in the case of drinking, how much water. You don't predetermine. You cannot predetermine how much food you will need each time you sit down to eat, because you don't know what your body is looking for. But your brain knows. Trust your brain. Don't watch TV or be involved with a very deep discussion when you are eating, because human conscious part of the brain cannot concentrate on two things at the same time. So if you are, that is why sometimes you're watching a TV, by the time you start enjoying the food, half the food is gone. You didn't even know
right.
it you have been eating.
Yeah.
Each bite, eat what you can bite. Each time you chew, you should be aware of that, the enjoyment. And then you will know, then the degree of enjoyment goes down. Take a sip of water. I suggest taking warm water. Why? Because you can clean up the taste buds, and the warm air will go up to the nose and clean up the smell receptors. By the way, the full flavor of your food comes not from the taste, but from combination of taste and smell. This is why when you have a cold, for example, food doesn't taste as good. Why? Your smell receptors are blocked.
And visual. If your food is pretty, you're probably going to want to eat more of it. But if it's ugly, you're probably just going to gulp it down, get it over with, and move on. So,
yes.
You know, there's those three things. You have to smell it, see it, and taste it.
Yes.
Listen, before I let you go, you are a cancer survivor as well, so you didn't just pull this out of the air to really look at. You had to survive it.
Yes. When I was diagnosed, I asked my doctor, why did I get it? And he said, no, the improper diet and lack of exercise. That's what he said. But if you go to another country, and I went to India, I asked the same question, and you get the same answer. If you go to China, if you go to South America, anywhere, they will say improper diet and lack of exercise. So that made me start thinking, how can you have improper diet and lack of exercise all over the world? They are eating different foods. That didn't make sense. That's where I started. And a few months ago, I was recategorized as a cancer survivor because it was 5 years after my treatment. So I followed what I am saying in this book, Surviving Cancer. I limit my grain-based food intake to maybe 20 to 30% or less. Some days I don't eat any grain-based foods, but if I eat, I may eat 2-3 tablespoons of a cereal in the morning. That's it. But that is what I have done, and I feel good about it because I have something I can do. The same with can you imagine the feelings of parents whose child has been diagnosed with cancer? I don't know if there is any worse feeling. But right now, they are dependent on the oncologist to do everything for the child. No, what I'm saying is you can do something. You can control the rate of multiplication of the cancer cell in that child's body by limiting the intake of grain-based foods. What does it do? One, it slows down the multiplication of cancer, which in turn makes it less likely to increase the dose of anti-cancer medications. In other words, the oncologists can use less medication compared to before. Even more important, we have got 400,000 people, young adults, who are childhood cancer survivors. Many of them have late effects of treatment. So imagine if we can reduce the quantity of treatment, the chemo, the radiation. When they get older, they don't have to suffer the late complications. And for that, you need to start the process now. Stop or reduce the amount of grain-based food the child takes if your child is diagnosed with cancer.
That makes sense. You know, my grandmother, she passed away a long time ago, but she would say, and with a perfectly straight face, and she meant it. Turns out she was very, very wise. She would say, "You are what you eat. You are what you drink." I can't argue with that.
No. You know, that is absolutely correct, and they lived it, and they will ask you to chew your food, sit down, and enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Well, Dr. John, it has been wonderful speaking with you, and thank you so much, and thank you for the books. I have them on my desk, and they're in a pile of books that I've already started reading, two of them, but I have a short stack of books that I'm going to be reading over the long holiday weekend, so thank you. So before I let you go, where can people find you, and if they have questions about your books or if they have questions about what you're talking about here, how can they find you?
All my books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and you can go to my website, drjohnonhealth.com. That is drjohnonhealth.com. I have animation videos explaining obesity, explaining type 2 diabetes, explaining cancer. So people can see what I'm talking about visually and understand. All I am asking people is to understand, you know, especially if you're a diabetic, you need answers. Why am I taking insulin? If I keep my A1C below 7, does that mean I can avoid complications? Where does that sugar go? When the blood sugar goes down in response to insulin, where does it go? Does it go out of the body? If not, how does it help me? All I need is answers. I'm asking the endocrinologist to prove me wrong. I'm fine with that. But until that time, we have to keep asking questions.
Oh, I agree with you. Well, thank you so much, and I hope people will take the time now during the holidays and before the new year when we're going to go to the gym, we're going to get better, we're going to get healthy. This is a good time to start thinking about or doing something that will help you get healthier, so when the new year does come, you've got it. You've got the mindset going. You're in control of your sugar and your grains and every, you know, you're working at it. That's all we ask. So, Dr. John, thank you so much. And I really appreciate you spending time, you know, with me here today. And before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and anywhere else you consume your business podcast. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Dr. John, thank you.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.